This week on Culture File, we've been talking mainly to Alex Ross about his big, huge, massive, and let's just say it, Wagnerian book on Wagnerism. In the book, Ross looks at the many ways Richard Wagner's innovations across multiple art forms spread through human culture, striking down not just musicians and composers, but poets and novelists and painters and filmmakers, philosophers and politicians. Buzzing behind all this community spread is Wagnerism's political influence. His mortal role in excusing and powering the greatest wrongs, the greatest atrocities humanity has inflicted and endured. So if anybody should, by now, to use the contemporary term of art, have been cancelled, then surely it should be the unrepentant anti-Semite and Nazi favourite Richard Wagner. And yet, performances of The Ring still happen. On this month's Culture File debate, we're possibly talking about artistic legacy and moral panics, about Twitter pylons and replowing the field of culture for a new crop, and maybe even how to make a better world. Joining us on the Zoom Wall of Joy are Alex Ross, New Yorker music critic and author of Wagnerism. Hi, Alex.
Hello, great to be back.
Screen studies scholar Zalia Salva, author of Mixed Race Cinema and of The Black Irish on Screen. Hi, Zalie.
Thank you for having me.
And curator Christopher Riopelle, who, amongst other things, recently helped stage an turned-out controversial Gauguin exhibition at London's National Gallery, about which the New York Times headline went, "Is it time Gauguin got cancelled?" Hello, Christopher.
Hello.
And the final brick in the wall of Zoom is Gregory Cole, author of Single Gay Christian, which looked at his own thinking through of his complex identity. Hi, Gregory.
Hi, good to be here.
Alex, you've spent recent years, it would seem, from the thickness of your Wagner book, deep in Wagner. How has his music been seen? Really, ever since the Franco-Prussian War, there was this attempt to really silence him and get him off the stage. He's somebody who's long been subject to potential cancellation.
Yeah, I mean, you could call Wagner the godfather of cancel culture, I suppose. I mean, even in the 1850s, he'd already caused so much controversy with his infamous anti-Semitic essay, Jewishness and Music, and with a whole series of pamphlets where he was making bombastic pronouncements about revolutionizing culture and revolutionizing all of humanity, that the topic had surfaced. You know, is this person too horrible, too difficult, too problematic to be taken seriously, to be played at all? And that went on until his death and then in the years beyond. But at the same time, the work was spreading in renown. It was reaching out and finding new listeners and new enthusiasts, and it crossed over into France and became such an influence on French Bohemia and the French avant-garde. It leapt over into Victorian England and Gilded Age America. There were Jewish Wagnerians and Black Wagnerians and gay Wagnerians. And so something about it just compelled attention. And that remains the case today. I mean, there's so many people who have difficulty with Wagner, justly so, but he is part of music history. You know, you can't learn to play a brass instrument without sort of learning Wagner. You know, he's so problematic, but he's also necessary. And he also represents systemic problems. You know, he's not this kind of isolated villain. And so the idea of just sort of canceling him and sort of making him go away, it's not going to happen. And I don't think it would be healthy either. We need to confront this. We need to talk about it. We need to put it in context. We need to sort of constantly challenge this figure even as we're paying attention to him.
Zalie, in the world of cinema and television, the standing of creators is intimately linked to their potential box office. The actual recouping of money seems to be a greater political drive than actually the moral standing of any of the creators. Is that something that's unique to the cinema industry?
When we're talking about cancel culture, so many artists who have been cancelled as such in recent times have continued to make a lot of money, and their work has often become more popular as a result. So with film, with theatre, with literature, we often see, as in, say, J.K. Rowling sales recently, artists getting a surge in popularity as a result of criticisms of their personal lives and their somewhat controversial beliefs. So I think that we do have a culture within film in particular, which has been quite slow to change. But certainly with the Me Too movement, with the Black Lives Matter movement, we have seen figures being called out and removed in some cases from the Academy, such as Roman Polanski, 40 years after being convicted of rape against a child. In terms of, I think, the Black Lives Matter movement, we've seen the Academy Awards start to make some really positive changes. So I think that there is a focus on the box office, and that has led to people turning a blind eye to certain poor behaviours in the past. But there's also an interest in maximising box office by having a global appeal and maximising audiences, which is starting to make the Academy broaden their appeal, include more Black voices, for example, and make the Oscars more diverse.
Gregory, look at this word cancel. I mean, it's a process that we can see happening since Wagner and even before that. Why has this word cancel come to represent maybe changes in artistic practice and movements, which are actually traditional almost?
I think there's a sort of fantasy within the idea of invoking cancellation. And it's the fantasy that as soon as you want something to be gone, it will then be gone. It can just be conveniently erased, and then we can interact with the world as if it had never existed. But in reality, it turns out that a lot of times the attempt to erase something, as Aelia is saying, can make it become even more salient. And I think, for instance, of the figure of Voldemort in our own J.K. Rowling's work, who is called He Who Must Not Be Named, and then in the refusal to name him becomes sort of the eternal antecedent who's always assumed. And so the more we attempt to erase him from the language, the more he becomes sort of salient and present. So I think there's a performance of a fiction that we can actually get rid of something that we would prefer to forget. But I think it is, in fact, a fiction. I think there's a lie that we would like to tell ourselves that things really can be gotten rid of in a thorough and final sense.
I suppose, Christopher, in terms of the exhibition, maybe you'd tell us about what happened when you were curating this Gauguin exhibition that happened in Canada originally and then happened in London, of an artist who at one time was not particularly controversial, but who is seen now through very contemporary eyes as a very problematic artist.
Well, our particular subject dealing with Gauguin was his portraits. Throughout his entire career, he only ever had one portrait commission, and it was rejected, but he painted portraits or created portraits all the time, always of people with whom he was involved in one or another increasingly complicated and fraught way. But it became particularly difficult when he gets to Tahiti in 1891 and enters into these sexual relationships with very young girls of 13 and 14 years of age, into what in fact he called marriages, but they were not married. He was married. He never divorced his wife. And so we had to confront what that was about, confront how colonialism and French imperialism allowed him to take advantage, allowed him to exercise colonial power over these young girls. And we decided quite early on that we had to be very frank about that and to examine, rather than the formal values of the pictures, to examine the power relations that allowed these portraits to exist.
How does that happen? Because you hang them on the wall and then people come and see them. So how do you go about framing them other than in wood and gold?
We frame them with words, words that people are listening to on their acoustic guide. We ourselves did not use the word cancel. We weren't that hip, I guess. But we did say, is it time to stop looking at him? And then also on the wall, pointing out this is a 14-year-old that he is sexually involved with in this picture at the moment of this picture. Many people find this problematical. And indeed, many people did and thanked us for being explicit about these things. Other people understood that one had to carry it further than his personal proclivities to an understanding of colonialism, racism, imperialism as well.
And I guess that's the most positive way of approaching problematic material. Does that always hold, that the inspiration to write a useful critique or to film a useful critique, is that enough to support problematic art?
Problematic art exists, so we have to find ways of approaching it and dealing with it and contextualizing it. As Gregory said earlier, this idea that we can sort of erase things is a fiction. And it's something that we've been doing for a very long time to some extent, but it doesn't stop those things from being in society. So in terms of film, blackface, for example, has been cut out of so many popular films that are still shown on television, White Christmas and so on. So there's an idea that we're erasing that, that we're saying this is no longer a practice that we support. But yet blackface reemerges sporadically on screen and continues to be something that plagues our societies. So it's not really possible for us to eliminate these things in any way, shape or form. So we have to find ways of dealing with them, whether that be through a text that accompanies the film, intertitles, or having national debates about these issues and talking about race and racism and how we want to position ourselves culturally.
But I guess there must be things that are beyond the pale. You know that Disney apparently recut lots of films, cartoons, when it put them on its streaming service. But there must be some films, and I think immediately of Birth of the Nation because of its Wagnerian links, that maybe there isn't any point in screening it.
Well, I think it's interesting that we're talking about Birth of a Nation in this light now, because when I started teaching, Birth of a Nation was always referred to as the film that launched narrative filmmaking. It was rarely referred to in terms of its racism. And for so many film students, it's the first film that they see. It's one of the critical texts that they deal with. And I think that that's appropriate in terms of the technical elements. And I think that it's appropriate that we acknowledge what was happening at that time. And this film, after all, led to the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan, which had more or less disappeared at that stage. So it is important for various reasons. I think it's also interesting to look at Griffith himself as a figure who, while he espoused these very far-right views, allegedly had a black mistress and continued with other films to try and undo some of the damage that he had done with The Birth of a Nation. And then you also have black revisions of that film that have been made, which have tried to address it from a different angle, both in terms of the film that came out of the same title a few years ago and its presence within films like Dear White People. So I think that it is a very harmful film in many ways, but it's also something that describes an element of society which is still present and which is still very relevant. So I think it's important that we continue to engage with it and acknowledge its cultural relevance.
I think, Gregory, that's really where we come up against cancellation in general, which is not that we find that these texts are somewhat outdated or that those views seem antediluvian in some ways. It's that there is an actual offence being caused by being what's exhibited or what's shown.
Yeah, I think we're always forced to confront with language a question of how we respond to language that is offensive. And one of the things that I have studied in my own research is derogatory terms and how groups of people have attempted to respond to the use of derogatory terms against them. And by and large, in my reading, the attempt to just remove a derogatory term altogether from discourse almost always fails and almost always heightens the intensity with which the term is read. But on the other hand, if we take, for instance, the term black, which prior to the 1950s is not the preferred term for people of color, colored is considered the more polite term. That's why the the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. That's the polite term. Until just before 1960, the Black Power movement and the Black Arts movement take up the word black and say, actually, the thing that this word names is something that we have no problem with. And so they enter into this derogatory discourse and they begin to rewrite it and say, what's the problem with being black? We think black is beautiful. And so black is beautiful becomes this slogan that's so effective in reclaiming the term that now it's hard to remember a time at which the term black was considered problematical.
And I think you've also written about how a kind of official and legal policing of terms can actually be counter-effective, particularly, for instance, derogatory terms used about gay people.
Yes. Yeah. There was a fascinating attempt where a group that called themselves Dykes on Bikes in San Francisco, this group tried to get a registered trademark. And they found that they were having legal problems because the government wanted to say, no, no, that's a derogatory term. You're not allowed to call yourselves Dykes on Bikes. And they said, but we've reclaimed the term. This word is actually now part of our productive sense of group identity. And so the legal battle came over the inability of government to flex as quickly as the language of identity itself could flex to recognize this term, though it used to be problematical, has actually become a productive way of constructing group identity.
Alex, one of the things that makes Wagner so resilient to criticism is the work itself. And this is something we kind of ignore because actually a lot of the time we're talking about the reception of the work and how people use it. What is it about Wagner that gives him such a varied group of followers? He's most famous, obviously, for Adolf Hitler's interest in him, but he did have a lot of other fans.
One fascinating strand of this phenomenon of Wagnerism, his influence on so many different groups, so many different art forms, and all across the political spectrum from left to right, is that Wagner found enthusiastic followers among groups who might have been expected to want to have nothing to do with him. So despite his anti-Semitism, there were many, many Jewish Wagnerians. And you know, some of them were very conservative and were sort of trying to Germanify and themselves and just sort of erase to some extent their own Jewish identity. But there were others who were perfectly open and positive about their Jewish identity, who nonetheless found Wagner inspiring. Another remarkable case is W.E.B. Du Bois, an enormous figure in the African-American civil rights movement, who was an almost worshipful Wagnerian. So Wagner was for him a model for how one can take one's mythic past and bring it back to life and make it modern. And he thought that black artists should be doing the same thing with their own traditions. And so you can sort of take Wagner is very German, sort of a very specific modus operandi, and apply it in a completely different context.
Christopher, that is one of the possibilities of art, that it has this kind of what would be called uses and gratifications kind of aspect. And when you in the gallery try and nail down a correct view, are you kind of also closing down the real possibilities of people taking work and using it for their own purposes?
Well, you know, as in any great picture gallery, ours is filled with swagger portraits of grand aristos. We are learning now that many of their extraordinary wealth derived from slave-run plantations in Jamaica and this sort of thing. The portraits remain very great, very strong works of their period. But at this point, our thinking is that the only thing we can do is to identify this, is to point this out to our visitors, to allow them to have that information at the same time as they think of look at the great Gainsborough or the great Zoffany, and to come to their own conclusions. If I could go, we also had that problem with Gauguin, who himself always used the words savage and barbarian to describe himself. Because he grew up in Peru, and on very little evidence, he claimed to be an Incan, and he claimed that savagery and barbarism was the one thing that separated himself from effete European culture and the one thing that allowed him to be creative. So as you said, as with Dyke, here he was resuscitating words that even then were coming to be derogatory.
You could say, though, that his position as a white Westerner allowed him, the freedom to choose identities in that respect.
Oh, absolutely. And he was one of the first masters throughout his career to realize that he could do that, that he could be everyone from Jesus Christ on, that he could simply assume identities because he was in charge as an artist of what he did, of what he produced.
Well, in a way, one of the whole purposes of cancel culture is that maybe the institutions have a problem seeing what the real values enshrined in a work of art are. And they actually, even though we belittle it all the time, they actually need this kind of Twitter gang, this Twitter alternative voice, in order to explain the very things they can't see.
I think one of the things that's interesting about social media platforms is that they have given marginalized groups a voice. But I think that another thing with social media and the democratization that it's enabled is that the influence of Black culture on popular culture has become a lot clearer. And that's enabled discussion of what the origins of different aspects of our culture are, but also why we enable or celebrate certain aspects of Black culture while denigrating others. But I think that one of the things that's interesting about cancel culture is that many people associate that the term itself and the practice with civil rights boycotts and with African-American activism. So while it's often associated with Twitter mobs and inhumane, cruel behavior online and a society which is losing the run of itself because we're becoming socially removed from one another, there is another aspect where people who previously have been denied a public voice are gaining that and are able to bring to the fore issues that are important to them, which may not have been seen as important to the mainstream in the past.
If I can agree with that, to speak a bit in praise of cancel culture, as it were, I think there's a sense in which canonicity in so many artistic and fields and otherwise, canonicity has been determined by who has power at any given time. And there's a sense in which this unseating of power, the fact that now more discursive power is given to more groups of people, to re-raise the question, is the canon that we've inherited as far as who is worth paying attention to, does that narrative still hold true for us now? Or are there other people who we would like to start paying attention to, and maybe we can stop paying attention to some voices or some art that has been elevated historically, but actually should be let go of in favor of other pieces, in favor of work from the margin that hasn't yet had sort of the power base behind it to make it accessible to a broader range of people?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important because we often, and we're going to continue using this word cancel culture, even though I think it has an ironic kind of twist to it. But one of the things that discussion, that pushback about cancel culture does is suggest that the whole conversation is about things we shouldn't look at, things we shouldn't consume. And in fact, the more interesting aspect I think that Gregory is alluding to there is that it actually opens up the question of, well, what should we be looking at? Which is a question that seems to be ignored quite a lot in moral panic about cancel culture.
Yeah, I think it's so valuable for us to remember that history telling is always an interested process, that in the way we frame what happened historically and which parts of it we should be remembering in our present moment, there are agendas that are driving that question. And the pulling apart at the seams of what should count as the important received works of art, the important received works of literature, and so forth. I think as we start to tease apart that question, we do rightfully discover, hey, there's actually really good writing being done shockingly by women and by people who aren't from the Western tradition and by people who are not, not traditionally straight sounding in whatever that meant. that in fact all these works do exist if for those with eyes to see them or ears to hear them. So I think just beginning to raise the question, is the narrative that we've received about what should be thought of as historically valuable worth questioning, so that we can locate, not so that we can conjure up something new, but so that we can locate something that has always existed, but simply hasn't had the salience to rise to our attention until now.
And there is this sort of nasty capitalist aspect to this, that what we're talking about is huge amounts of production which is not being used, which is not being turned into money. And that's a thing that can happen by reforming the canon, by replowing the ground.
Well, I think it's one of the areas in which popular culture has led the way. Popular culture has, in certain aspects, been far more open than the elite culture of major cultural institutions. We're catching up.
I recently watched a documentary on the BBC on Black British art. This was based on an academic research project, and the research project leads, they were looking at one particular region in the north of England, and they found a huge number of works by Black British artists which were in the archives. And from that, they were able to put on an exhibition and produce a research paper, and they were hoping to get a lot more funding for that work. But it was fascinating to learn that there were so many artists, but who had not only been working in England and exhibiting, but who had achieved positions of national acclaim, but their success was always very short-lived. It was a trend which would then fall out of fashion, much as we've seen with Black directors in the film world, that there'll be a focus for a period of time and then it'll fall away again.
Are we in one of those moments now? Are we in a moment that will die away again, and then all these new voices that we're beginning to hear will again be excluded or ignored?
It seems to me that this moment is substantively different in just the democratizing of so many different voices through mediums like Twitter. Because previously, if the main mode that we have to look for the vox populi is to see how the trends of money flow, then we have a pretty monocular view of what people want. Money speaks, but Twitter also speaks. And the fact that people are now able to articulate in more ways, if you made this, I would spend money on that instead. The fact that we can see, you know, the success of a film franchise like Black Panther, for instance, speaks to the fact that sometimes if money is taken in a different direction, we can see that people will happily hop on that train. And so I think the fact that people have a voice beyond just participating in capitalism does make this moment stand out as in some ways distinctive.
I think that from those who have been through these moments before, from those who are still around from the civil rights era, for example, many individuals have noted a shift that they feel is a palpable change in society that isn't something that they've witnessed before. I think in particular that the mainstream has really taken this on, has been a very positive step forward. I hope that we're seeing something which is going to lead to systemic change, but there's no guarantee if we look at examples from history.
That's two very hopeful views, so I think that might be the moment to stop before it all turns nasty again. I'd like to thank all of our guests this time, Alex Ross, Zelia Sava, Christopher Riopel and Gregory Cole. Having said, without fear of contradiction, the absolutely final word on art and morality. We'll convene another Culture File panel next month. Till then, goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm glad it's all great. Solved now.
Yes,
it was. Figured it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Phew. Yeah.